Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Grave Danger by Danielle Gerard. Narrated by Rachel DeLude. Chapter 1. Oyster Point was not where one expected to find a police warehouse full of guns. Over the past couple of decades, the area had actually become a rather attractive corporate park. The adjacent marina housed expensive yachts, and a well-developed trail system ran along the water. Natural grasses swayed in the wind. It was all very quaint and peaceful, not at all the way the place had been 20 years earlier, when it was basically the cheapest available office space in the area. JT wasn't there to enjoy the view and didn't give a damn about natural grasses. The whole place could have gone up in flames. The only concern was that economic prosperity meant tight security, which translated into extra time to set things up. 18 years was a long time to wait for payoff. But maybe the waiting was done. JT smoothed the gloves one last time and followed the trail. Even in the dim pre-dawn light, the phone box was easy to find. Phone companies hired human monkeys, then gave them an impossible-to-screw-up set of instructions. In JT's experience, the monkeys still managed to do things wrong, maybe half the time, evidenced by the fact that the phone box wasn't even locked. A pair of wire cutters and the lines would be down. 10 seconds tops, but first, Sam's cell phone jammer had to be working. At this moment, Sam was in the small apartment adjacent to the garage, predictably huddled over his desk. He was likely working on the night's third or fourth big gulp of Mountain Dew. The empties would be lined along the desk like fat children at the edge of the playground. Sam was waiting, something he did by playing Minecraft or breaking into small nonprofits and finding ways to occupy himself. Last week, he hacked into a San Jose animal shelter and changed the names of the residents. A 6-year-old calico was now called Big Red Pussy, a golden doodle, who had been named Betsy, was now Curly Bitch, and a Rottweiler that had lost an eye in a street fight had been renamed One-Eyed Dick. Sam thought this was hilarious. Thankfully, Sam was not a field guy. For one, he didn't even have a driver's license, but he was also about as stealthy as farming equipment. No, Sam was hardly even a behind-the-scenes guy. Sam was a train wreck, but Sam could also be managed. Mostly this was accomplished by keeping Sam away from other people, which wasn't difficult because Sam preferred the company of other online nerds, sitting in their own dungeons, drinking their own big gulps, and eating some similar diet to Sam's daily feasts of Cheetos and microwave burritos. Now, to work. The backpack dropped gently on the ground. The cell phone jammer was in a small cardboard box surrounded in bubble wrap. Sam tended to go overboard on packaging. The device was a silver box not much bigger than a box of Tic Tacs, with a black antenna coming out of each end. In the center was a silver switch. In Sam's girlish print, the left side read off and the right side on. Only gloves touched the box as the switch was flipped from off to on. The call to Sam's number failed, which meant the jammer was working. The clippers made a satisfying snip through the wires, and in under a minute, the first step was done. At the front of the building, Hank waited in the black van. Hank was a monkey, too, but of a different sort. JT might have brought Carl instead, but Carl was smarter, and JT didn't want any extra questions. Plus, all interactions with Carl had been electronic. JT had never seen his face, nor the other way around, and JT was hesitant to change that. The fewer people JT dealt with in person, the better. JT raised a hand, and Hank emerged excitedly from the van and slammed the door closed.
"Watch the noise."
"Sorry, boss,"
Hank said. He shouldered an oversized duffel that seemed mostly empty.
"Monkey."
"You have what you need?"
JT asked. Hank patted his bag and nodded.
"Okay, it's your turn."
Hank approached the warehouse's back door with its 4-digit entry lock. He, too, wore gloves as he pulled a crowbar from the duffel bag and worked the end of it into the narrow opening between the door and the jamb, rocking it up and down until it was wedged in far enough to begin to muscle it. The trim came off first with a loud snap as the thin metal broke away from the front of the building. Hank's hands slipped, and he dropped the crowbar, which made a loud clattering sound on the pavement. It rang out like a bullet shot.
"Jesus Christ!"
"Sorry," Hank muttered again. He removed a long, pick-like tool and a rubber mallet from the back and created a dent in the metal door just above the knob until the latch was fully exposed. With the crowbar, he wrenched it open. Hank was built like a tank. It took all of 7 minutes before the door fell open. They stepped into the warehouse together, and Hank let the door close behind them. Softly. A first. The space smelled of old paper and lemon cleaner. The smell meant someone still cleaned the place, so their footprints would be harder to track. That was good news. The lights were off across the warehouse and the temperature cool. Not the kind of place where someone was working, especially not at this hour. Skylights lined the wall almost at the ceiling, which meant someone might notice if they turned on the lights. JT pulled a flashlight out of the small side pocket of the backpack and flipped it on. "You got yours?" Hank found his flashlight, and the two of them scanned their lights across the inside. The warehouse space was small and lined with shelves where boxes were piled high. Police case files. Overflow. This was not the interesting part. That was in the far corner. "This way." Hank followed, finally quiet, as they crossed the warehouse to the last aisle, where a cage took up the far corner. JT stood back. Hank used his crowbar to open the locked gate in under a minute. The cage was lined with metal cabinets, some green, some gray, all old-style and flimsy. The first took Hank approximately 15 seconds to jimmy open. Hank whistled at the contents, the shelves lined with semi-auto assault rifles, each tagged with a case number.
"Load those up, and the other cabinets, too," JT said. "We don't need all of them. You've got 4 minutes."
Hank pulled two empty black duffels out from the one that carried his tools and dropped them on the floor. He opened the first and started loading guns. There was a more important task to be done while Hank stole the weapons. JT exited the cage and returned to the main area of the warehouse, using 20 precious seconds to scan the rows before deciding on the placement. The second row seemed the best, most out of the way. Against the wall, certainly, to allow Sam the best signal. JT chose a box from the second shelf, two down. With the box carefully set on the warehouse floor, JT loaded the larger of two computers from the backpack into the box. The computer was an inexpensive one, an Acer, purchased at Walmart while dressed in a business suit and leather gloves and scarf for the chilly day. And a wig. With cash. 3 months ago. Three others were purchased under similar circumstances in case Sam needed them. A disposable cell phone and an independent battery source were strapped to the computer with Hello Kitty duct tape. Sam's idea of a joke. Sam had bought the tape himself. None of JT's prints would be on anything. Sam had been warned. JT had gone so far as to bring him a box of extra-large sterile gloves to fit his big, chubby hands. But Sam was sloppy. Hackers, in general, were sloppy creatures, JT had learned. Careless criminals. They coveted bragging rights over anonymity. The process over the results. Easily manipulated, too, by the right person. Sam was no different. The second device was a Raspberry Pi, a computer that was no larger than a deck of playing cards. That needed to be higher. JT tested the shelves. The metal shelving was inexpensive. Empty, they would be easy to topple, but the weight of the old case files held them steady. Even spacing made scaling them relatively easy. JT set the small computer, with its own battery pack and cell phone, on the top shelf before climbing up and reaching to the ceiling. The acoustic ceiling tiles were loose,
The first one opened up without any trouble. It was almost too easy. Lousy security for police storage. The bundle weighed maybe 20 ounces, mostly from the weight of the battery. JT slid it up into the ceiling so it set against the building's outside wall and rested on the metal crossbars between acoustic tiles. Checked it twice. The tile slid back down smoothly. It looked just like the others. Everything was as it had been. JT climbed down, retrieved the backpack, and returned to the weapons cage, where Hank was loading his last pack. As predicted, Hank had left nothing behind. The guns were superfluous, but Hank was a common thief, and common thieves lacked awareness of when enough was enough. Without mention of his excessive exuberance, Hank loaded the remaining handguns into the duffel. Hank didn't ask about the 4 minutes of absence. Lack of curiosity and brute strength were Hank's best features. Hank wiped his gloved hands on his pants.
"That's all of it, boss."
The two made their way outside and pushed the door closed. Up close, there would be no missing the damage to the door, but from a distance, it would be hard to see. JT flipped the cell phone jammer off before turning to the backpack to retrieve its packaging.
"JT!"
JT started and spun at the sound of Hank's voice.
"Jesus Christ!"
There was the sound of metal on metal. The jammer fell between the phone box and the exterior wall of the building. JT tried to retrieve it, but it was wedged down out of reach. Hank backed up.
"Sorry, JT, I wanted to know if you wanted me to wait or go to the van."
JT said nothing. The jammer was off, but leaving it was a bad idea. This was supposed to look like a smash and grab. The jammer was too sophisticated for an average burglar. JT dropped the pack.
"Give me the pick."
Hank rattled through the guns in search of the pick. JT focused on staying calm, eyes closed, deep in, deep out. No breaking necks, not yet.
"There it is."
Hank started to pull the tool free, but it caught up on a gun. Suddenly, a shot fired. They both ducked as a bullet struck the passenger side window glass on a utility vehicle parked in back. Glass exploded. Without hesitating, JT grabbed the backpack in one hand and one of the duffels in the other and started for the car. Hank was right behind with the other two duffels. The jammer was gone. There was no getting it now.
"Shit, boss," Hank said, panting. "I had no idea the guns would be loaded." "Don't speak. Did you think they would be loaded?"
Hank went on, nearly whining.
"Do not speak,"
JT repeated, fighting for control. Hank was disposable, but at that moment, it couldn't happen fast enough for JT. Thankfully, Hank went quiet, although he continued to make little sighs and huffs like a high school girl. The need to talk obviously making him crazy. Despite the broken glass, the streets were quiet as they opened the back of the van. Hank was sheepish as he loaded the bags. JT slid in the side door and pointed to the driver's seat.
"You drive. I'm going to sit back here and see what we got."
The take couldn't have been less interesting. That was not the reason JT chose the back. It was about not being up front with Hank. Especially if something went wrong. Something else.
"We heading home?"
he asked.
"Yeah."
Hank pulled away from the curb with a jolt that knocked everything, JT included, toward the rear of the van.
"Sorry, boss."
JT did not respond. It was over. A mile away, the text came in from Sam. "I can see the networks working to get in now." JT knew Sam would ask for the jammer. As much as JT would have liked it, Sam would not be distracted by the importance of his task. He'd want his toy back, and he would not take the loss well. JT would have to pretend the jammer wasn't lost. Hopefully, Sam could be put off for a day or two while JT pretended to find it. Better to let him focus on one thing at a time. The worst was over. Now it was a matter of some cleanup. Out the windshield, a light turned yellow, and Hank accelerated hard. Again, everything slid to the back of the van. Then there was the loud honk of a siren turning on and the glow of flashing red and blue lights. A cop.
Fuck. "Boss?"
Hank called in a panic.
"Pull over, Hank. Stay calm."
The cop car parked, and Hank twisted his hands over the steering wheel. Take your gloves off, Hank, and don't let on that I'm here. I'll tell you when to go.
The plates on the van were stolen. It wouldn't do to have them run. Things were about to get messy, but JT was good with improvisation. Hank, on the other hand, was not. The cop car cracked open, and a single officer started for the van. He had a blonde goatee and a wide upper body, the kind of young officer who probably spent a lot of free time at the gym. His left hand hovered on the butt of his gun. A left-handed cop was at a disadvantage. JT was surprised he didn't come around the passenger side. Instead, he approached the driver's side with his gun on the outside. Inside, the Sig Sauer P250, complete with silencer, was now aimed at his head through the van's tinted side window. When the officer reached the back bumper, Hank started to roll his window down. JT released the Sig safety. The cop's stride reached the middle of the van. The trigger eased back. One, glass exploded. Two, bullets lodged themselves in the cop's head. Hank screamed. The officer fell to the pavement. There was a short twitch in his left foot, then nothing. Done and done cleanly.
Let's go, Hank,
JT whispered. The police car's camera would pick up everything. JT didn't want their voices recorded, but it would be hard to miss Hank's screaming.
Drive now,
JT hissed again, but Hank hadn't heard. JT crawled up toward the driver's seat and, resisting the temptation to put a bullet in Hank's head too, whispered,
Come on, we have to go.
Hank lurched forward, and JT held tightly as the van swerved onto the street. At the corner, Hank turned right, driving in the opposite direction of home. He was hysterical. He made it around the corner and out of the view of the police car's camera, at least.
Okay, stop here, JT said. I'll drive.
Hank stopped the car in the middle of the road. Obviously, he had never seen anyone shot before. And it was such a clean job, too. He ought to have been impressed. The two switched places, and Hank sank down against the wall of the van and pulled his knees to his chest. He made moaning sounds for the remainder of the drive.
It's okay, Hank.
There were no other incidents. The garage door slid open, and soon the van was inside with the door closed behind them. Only with the engine off did Hank pull himself from his fetal position and move toward the door. Hank had his hand on the van's door handle, the back of his head cleanly exposed, when the two bullets entered the back of his skull. The bullets didn't break the glass, so the mess was contained in the van. At least that had gone right. It would all stay there for a few hours. Right now, the only pressing matters were a shower and a beer. Even at 5 a.m., JT was ready for a drink. Chapter 2 Mei Ling sat in the back corner of the special ops van and studied her computer screen in the strange glow of the van's red interior lights. Around her, officers donned heavy raid gear, thick black suits and combat boots and helmets with goggles. Mei was working to make herself small in the crowded space. Not that she was large to begin with. The van was maybe 20 feet long and had seemed spacious when they were all seated, but with 10 team members, the captain, and equipment everywhere, it felt significantly smaller now. Mei was working to hack the login on the computer they'd seized from Will Wigman, who the police believed was the meth ring's money guy. If she could break into it before Special Ops got into the building, they could obtain additional search warrants and cast a wider net. Unfortunately, the Special Ops team was gearing up, and the brute force password dongle she'd plugged into the computer's USB port was still working on cracking the password. Mei was also waiting for AT&T to respond to their subpoena for the guy's cell phone records. The lab had even gotten the DA's office to issue a subpoena to Apple to gain access to whatever they could see from his Apple ID. Anything to give them some added insight. But waiting was a lot of what they did. Computer forensics was never a speedy process, but watching the program from the inside of the special ops bus made it seem slower. Even glaciers melted faster than computer forensics these days, what with climate change and all. All around Mei, the special ops team was moving, quickly, efficiently, in a way the computer team never could.
May wished she'd opted to do this from the lab, although then she would have had to deal with Aaron Pollock and her new team, and that was less than ideal, too. Cameron Cruz sat down beside May and pulled on a thick black jumpsuit. What do you think of special ops?
A little different from the lab.
May motioned to Cameron's suit.
No, I've got a suit just like that. I would have worn it, but it's at the cleaners.
You'd look great in one of these, Cameron told her, and men love this look. Diego Ramirez laughed and reached down to tie his wife's boot, but Cameron elbowed him away playfully. Diego laughed.
It's true, we dig it, he said, giving Cameron a quick kiss.
May glanced at her computer screen.
Get a room already!
One of the other guys ribbed the lovebirds. May couldn't remember his name.
Seriously, you guys don't spend enough time together off the job?
Another one joked. Cameron and Diego were the only couple May knew who both lived together and worked on the same team at the department. Diego waved them off.
Hey, we're making up for lost time.
Looking back at his wife, though, he couldn't contain his smile. And when Cameron turned her back to pull on her Kevlar vest, she was grinning too. It was like they were getting ready to go on a scuba diving trip rather than into the center of a known meth ring. Despite the flirting, Cameron and Diego moved with purpose. No wasted time as they donned equipment, belts, helmets, gloves. Cameron might have been 5'8 or 9, but she couldn't have weighed much more than 130 pounds, and the equipment she had on had to weigh another 35 or 40. In law enforcement for more than 10 years, May had never donned a bulletproof vest or a gun on the job. She did her mandatory firearms training, but she was way more at home with a mouse than a Glock. May minimized the screen on the decryption program and pulled up the GPS coordinates. The tracking device they'd put on their mole still hadn't moved.
Anything?
Special Ops Sergeant Lau asked May. She shook her head and glanced at the timer that recorded how long the device had been still.
Hasn't moved in nearly 14 hours.
The group sobered up. The tracking device was his phone. It was possible the small tracking chip had been discovered and left behind. In May's experience, when a tracking device was discovered, it was usually dumped. She'd spent plenty of days tracking devices to dumpsters or off bridges and into lakes. It was also conceivable that their inside guy had left his phone. It was normal to see gaps in movement of between 7 and 10 hours. People slept, after all. But with the sensitivity of the tracker and her equipment, May could see the movement of the phone off the bedside table, even just a few inches, let alone if it moved across the room. People tended to bring their phones with them from one room to another. This one had not moved a millimeter in 14 hours. That was not good. Nothing to do now but wait for the team to go in and check it out. Ramirez led the team through the layout and plan, and May watched. Her phone vibrated. Her mother was calling again. She sent the call to voicemail and texted her mother for the third time that morning. At a scene. She'd take hell for that later. May heard shouts, and the team lined up. Moved out. Sergeant Lau went with them and reached inside to close the doors. May was alone with her computer. Most days, she ran this kind of program while she was doing a half dozen other things. Computer programs always took twice as long when they were being watched. May heard the ding of the dongle. The password was Betsy1082. Quickly, May typed it in and without a breath, ran a recursive find command, looking for anything with a modified date in the last week. 5 seconds later, the images began to load. May moved through them quickly. The first two were black, most likely accidental. The next image was hard to see, taken from a distance. She double-clicked the thumbnail so the picture filled the screen. At first, the tint of the skin made it look like a costume mask tossed on a pillow. The skin was gray-green where the neck disappeared under the white sheet, the bulk of his torso under the covers. A dead man. Maybe Wigman, but she didn't know what he looked like. May loaded the next image. Somewhere else, two large green soda bottles sat on a countertop. They looked old, their labels long gone.
Each was partially full. Rubber was wrapped around the tops, and a single tube ran from one to the other. Beside them was a glass bottle, maybe half their size. Its label was turned away from the camera. May quickly scanned the next few images. They seemed to document the place in a full circle. Empty bed through the doorway, a single ratty brown couch in the living room, kitchen with a 70s-style refrigerator in yellow. In the center, a small card table with one chair and the counter lined with the soda bottles. She enlarged the photo. Beside the bottles was a small blue plastic bottle. Though blurry, she could read the words at the top of the glass bottle. Ethyl alcohol, USP. Below that, in bright red letters, it read 200 proof. Ethanol. In the next image, she saw a label that read H3PO2. Her chemistry wasn't good enough for that one. Instead, she Googled it. It was a substitute for red phosphorus in the production of meth and highly explosive. A meth lab. May scanned back through the images to the one with the body. In the background was a window and a single shade. May jumped up from the computer, catching her foot on the chair that was bolted to the floor. She stumbled across the van and pressed herself against the windows, stared up at the building as she had been doing when they arrived. The team was walking into a meth lab. No, no, no! May turned and scanned the tabletop. The radio. Where the hell was it? She sprinted for the radio on the dash. Sergeant Lau, do not enter the building. I repeat, do not enter. The radio was silent. Send back up. Sergeant Lau's team is entering a meth lab. Lau, don't go in there, she called more desperately. She watched out the window, anticipating an explosion. When there was no answer, May opened the bus door and ran down the stairs. Cameron, Diego, she screamed down the block. She wasn't exactly sure how they'd entered the building. Get away from there! Clear the area! Were they already inside? Even a cell phone call could trigger an explosion. Call 911. She ran back onto the bus for her cell phone, dialed 911.
Dispatch, what is the address of your emergency?
This is Officer May Ling. I'm with the special ops team, and we have a potential ethanol leak. It hasn't blown yet, but the team is up there. They don't know it's an active meth production. We need to get through to them and tell them to get away from that building before it blows. We need firefighters and a bomb squad and ambulances.
Officer, slow down.
May glanced at the image on her computer. 2-liter-sized soda bottles and ether alcohol. Maybe it wouldn't blow, but there had to be enough ethanol in that air to kill Wigman. Send back up. This place is a meth lab. There was a loud smack on the side of the bus, and May jumped. Sergeant Lau's face appeared through the glass. He gave her a tentative smile, which was followed by the comforting thunder of heavy boots on the bus stairs.
What's all the commotion? Diego asked.
May watched them all flood back onto the bus, all 10 of them, plus Lau. Only then did she finally take a full breath of air.
What did you find?
Lau asked, coming up behind her shoulder. May double-clicked on the image of the meth lab and turned the computer toward the group hovered around her.
That could be anywhere, one of the guys said. May, what made you so sure that picture is of this place?
Lau asked. In the distance, May heard the low whine of sirens. She navigated back to the image and zoomed into the window. She pointed to the broken blind that hung asymmetrically in the window. See that?
The shade?
Cameron asked. May nodded. Look up at the building, she told them. Farthest window on the right. The officers moved across the van. It took them a minute to find it.
Holy shit, Diego said. That place is a meth lab.
May sank into her chair. That's what I've been telling you. Chapter 3. May was late for dinner with her aunt. Again. As May had called her since she was little, was planning another feast in her celebration of the Chinese Ghost Festival. For 2 nights in the past week, I had made hugely elaborate meals and served them to empty seats at her dining room table as though their dead relatives were dining with them. As a child, May had loved the Ghost Festival, her favorite of the Chinese celebrations. China's version of Halloween. The Ghost Festival had appealed to May's sometimes morbid curiosity about death and the afterlife. The Ghost Festival was a time when her mother filled their small apartment with the most delicious smells, and everywhere in Chicago's Chinatown, people burned incense, joss paper, and fake money to worship their ancestors.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?